welcome to episode 68 of React Native Radio. I'm your host, Nader Dabit. Today on our panel, we have Peter Pykarczyk from Preposterous.
Hey, everybody.
Gant Laborde of Infinite Red.
Welcome.
And our special guest today is Eric Normand. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you doing? I'm so happy to be here.
Glad to have you on. So, Eric, we're going to be talking about a lot of different things, I guess we would say, than our typical just React Native specific stuff. We might dive into a little bit of Clojure, maybe talking about compile to JavaScript stuff and kind of everything going on in that ecosystem right now. But before we kind of jump into our topic in general, can you kind of give us a quick overview of maybe how you got into programming, what you're doing now, and kind of what all you're working on?
Wow, how I got into programming. Wow, that was a long time ago. I had very supportive parents. I remember when I must have been 6 or 7. I was in school and I was in a meeting with my mom and my teacher. And my teacher asked me what I would like to do, research, explore. And for some reason, I said computer programming. I had no idea what that was at that time. And my mom looked at me and was like, really, that's what you want to do? And, she helped me the whole way. We spent a lot of time on the computer and I got my own computer at some point, and I just really like programming. What I like most about it is that just like an artist or a poet, you spend a lot of time in the world of ideas. You're constructing ideas. And I really like that. It's like world building, building a Middle Earth or something, like how things are supposed to work. Yeah, that's one of the reasons I like functional programming, because I feel like it operates a lot in that world of ideas. I got into functional programming about 15 years ago while I was still in college. And I just really like it. I'm glad to see that functional programming is now getting a lot of people are talking about it. It's getting a lot of attention, and it's now more possible than ever to be a gainfully employed functional programmer.
What was functional programming like 15 years ago? Like what was going on in that space?
Well, the big one was Common Lisp. Common Lisp was written in the late 80s and really hadn't developed much since then. I mean, it'd been, modernized and ported to the operating systems at that time. A lot of the web happened in the 90s, and so there were web frameworks and stuff like that. So yeah, that was where most of my time was spent, in Common Lisp. And it's actually a really nice system.
Common Lisp is that programming language millennials put on their Twitter profile and say they know?
I guess so. I'm getting kind of old, long in the tooth. I don't really track what millennials are doing that these days.
I'm a millennial and I see it all the time, Lisp programmer, I'm like, sure you are, you're probably just doing functional JavaScript, or you think you
right.
do.
right. Well, Lispers have always been sort of relegated to the shadows. They haven't been able to get paid to do it. So someone who's doing functional JavaScript might very well go home and type a bunch of parentheses and play with it at home. But nowadays, with Clojure and other options, it's much more possible to be doing that and get paid to do it, which I think is great. And it's kind of what I'm trying to do with my business. It's called purelyfunctional.tv. I make Clojure video tutorials. And more broadly, I try to help people transition their career from, the language that they might not be that interested in, that they're working in, to a career in functional programming. And Clojure is kind of like the gateway drug for that, because it's if you know Java, for instance, it's an easier transition than learning something completely new. So a lot of people who are trying to transition their careers, they got stuck in a language because there wasn't much opportunity in other languages back in the day. Now they're older, they have a you know, a mortgage and kids, and they don't, they're afraid that they won't find jobs and they'll have to take a pay cut, which is totally untrue. There's lots of jobs. The closure jobs are well paid. And so, yeah, I try to help them transition over, find the job, work on their resume, get some side projects going, learn the basics that they need, and yeah, really help them get going.
That's amazing. Do you think that you would ever consider doing a JavaScript to closure sort of lesson, or you think that's just too simple and it would just not benefit anybody? Or do you think that perhaps, like, here it is in JavaScript functional, all right, now let's go ahead and see what happens here.
You mean like a closure script for JavaScript programmers, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I guess, like, since closure script, you've seen it as a gateway drug. Yeah. I agree with you. I think that a lot of people are looking towards sort of taking this language, this sort of compiled, or like this sort of checking that happens, this transpiling step. But we're all still stuck in JavaScript, right?
Right.
So I didn't know if you were looking at perhaps maybe even extending that gateway drug a little further.
So it's an interesting question. One thing that I have really thought about is whether enough people to make it a profitable business are actually going to be transitioning over to a new right. language. And maybe it would be much better to just focus on functional JavaScript. And there are some some good books about functional JavaScript, a lot of good blog posts, but they're not that practical. They're usually just talking kind of like lambda calculus gymnastics is what I like to call it. That they're just like, look, I can take this function and do this other thing, and I can represent numbers as functions. And that's not really, I mean, that's very fun and very useful. And in fact, people who advance in functional programming, the better ones usually get into that stuff because it is kind of neat. And in some way, it kind of rewires your brain to think of problems differently. But as an introduction, I don't think it's that useful. I would rather be able to teach someone how to use map, filter, and reduce very effectively and sort of in a way that you could show, like, this has real value to your code right now. You take your for loops and just replace them with map, filter, and reduce, and your code is better. It's shorter, it's clearer, the intent is clearer. You have fewer bugs because there's like less initialization to do at each point. And you know, start there. Start with like the very basics, the stuff that you can kind of guarantee is going to have a benefit.
That's interesting that you mentioned map, filter, reduce. I have a blog post that I'm almost finished with that's called the 80-20 rule of functional JavaScript. And I'm kind of talking about how you can kind of take just a small amount of array methods and kind of get like 90% of your work done. And those are the three methods that I'm kind of going over. What does functional JavaScript mean to you, like, right now, in the sense of kind of what you just talked about? Like, is it kind of just using these methods, or is it also about currying and other things? Or like, what do you say? Like, if someone is like, I want to get into functional JavaScript programming and I want it to like be applicable to my day-to-day work.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the main reason I haven't just jumped in and made this course is I feel like I don't really know what it means. Because as a long-term functional programmer, that's just what I do. And so to step back and see what JavaScript programmers who need, what do they need? And how can it be something where they don't have to spend 15 years to get there? So yeah, map, filter, and reduce is a big thing. I see it even with closure programmers, you know, people learning closure, they just miss that things could be a map, things could be a filter, things could be a reduce. And when I like help them, I pair with them, I'm like, this is obviously a map, but then I, you know, I need to be able to explain, like, how do you see that? How do you see that this could be a map? And so it would be a lot of that. Just, you know, map, filter, and reduce. I would say just Lodash, you know, like just teach Lodash and show how these things can be chained together and put together in new ways. I would love to get into like higher order thinking, but I feel like as a first course, just like start using map, filter, and reduce, and just see how much better your code is because of that.
You're absolutely right, because I've been mentoring this, you know, fresh kid right out of school, right? He's not bad at JavaScript, but obviously he's got a lot to learn. And, you know, some things I'm just like, man, like, you know, like I could totally see it, you know, like just filter it, you know, or use map, you know, and I forget that I almost like forgot how to do it otherwise, you know, but it's almost like enlightening to see him go through the process, because it makes me understand like, okay, like I have to figure out the path for you to get from what you're doing now to being able to use map, filter, and reduce. And I think that's been super, super helpful for me, you know, as like a mentor and a teacher, you know, so you forget about it.
Yeah, for sure. You know, especially teaching a language like Clojure where you don't have for loops. So people coming in, they're like, well, so how do I do a for loop? I'm like, well, you can't actually do that. But so like, tell me what you want to do. And then you have to kind of be like guide them into thinking, well, is it something where you're taking an existing sequence and transforming all the elements, you know, that's a map, or are you, you know, removing some of the elements? Well, that's a filter. Or are you building up another value? Well, that's a reduce. And those ways of thinking are not really what people think. They think, I have an array, it's got a bunch of elements, I'm going to make something new out of it. And that they just jump into a for loop and start iterating through stuff. It's just the way we're usually taught. And then we have for loops in most languages. So they're used to just translating their knowledge from one to the other. And it's more like, what is the syntax for for loops in this language? And not, you know, what am I really trying to do here? And what's the best tool for that?
Well, yeah, I mean, essentially the concept has to translate over as well of like, you know, staying away from mutating some sort of state. So I think what's funny is when you look at it, you kind of hit the nail on the head. Whenever someone comes from a different language and then they start looking at functional programming, it's like a 10-second countdown until somebody mentions monads to feel intelligent. And yeah. Then the person just walks away pretty upset. And I find that that's going away now, fortunately.
Yeah.
People are being a bit less academic with functional programming, and I think that's helping people out a lot. Another thing I think that helps, and I want to get your opinion on it, would you say that functional programming has sort of grown in JavaScript because JavaScript's been notoriously terrible at object-oriented programming?
I think JavaScript is one of the best things to happen to Clojure, to functional programming. Sorry. It is taught people about first-class functions. It's taught people about higher-order functions. So you're passing callbacks all over the place.
Yeah.
There's even a, you know, if you take a computer science course on compilers, you might learn something called continuation passing style, which is exactly what you do with callbacks in JavaScript all the time. And it's one of these courses where like you're like scratching your head trying to convert code from one style into another, and it's so hard. But in JavaScript, we just write it naturally, like, because that's just what we have to do in JavaScript. And so I think that JavaScript has introduced people to a lot of these concepts that, in a way that, you know, maybe a theorist would cringe at because they're using the wrong word or something like that. But it's there. Like the ideas are there in people's heads, in real programmers' heads. They're actually being used practically. And so I think there's a great opportunity there. Unfortunately, and this is not a, you know, I'm not trying to like beat down on JavaScript. But unfortunately, JavaScript does tend, the people in JavaScript do tend more toward the like object-oriented and procedural sides. So that doesn't really help the functional stuff. Because when the going gets tough, you don't call map, you just like use a for loop.
But that's because like all the tutorials online, you know, like are doing that, you know. I'm going to be premature about my pick, but I just want to stress how awesome it was for me. So I got lucky a few years ago and read JavaScript Elongée by Reginald Brightworth. And, you know, this was before I knew functional programming was a thing. I was applying at Trunk Club and being like, hey, check out this, you know, compose function. You know, like, this is my function cook and this is my function eat. And then I can just wrap it, you know, in a cook and eat function. And, you know, it just like works out really nicely, you know. Mm-hmm. And everybody was like, oh, that's, you know, that's cool, you know, but we don't do that. We do object oriented, you know.
Right.
But, you know, like here we, like literally a year later, you know, we're looking at like React and then Redux and like, boom, like Compose is like right there. You know, it's like, right. Oh, wow, like we could do this with that. Like, holy, you know, I didn't get it at the time. You know, I just got lucky that I read this book and, you know, learned about partial application and started naming things like pluck with and get with, you know, and sure. Just thinking about it in that regard, and reading a good book on a topic, something like, you know, I don't know if there's many JavaScript Elongées, I'm sure there is, but just reading a book on that topic where it shows you real world examples of how you can apply this to your work has made a huge impact on, you know, my understanding of functional programming in JavaScript.
Well, I have a lot to say about that. That's actually a really cool story. Another book that I like is JavaScript, The Good Parts. It's kind of a functional programming book in disguise. And one of the things that I really appreciate about the book is he really breaks down in the parts that he says are good, which are usually the functional parts. He really breaks down the stuff into their component parts. So in object-oriented programming, we tend to like want to build something big, like a big class that does all this stuff for us. And the problem is when you have something big, it's much less likely to be A, correct, and B, reusable, because it probably does something you don't want it to do in every case. And sure, it feels good when you do find a reuse for that because it's big and you're saving all this code. But usually you want something smaller. Smaller things tend to be more correct and more like timeless. I'm doing air quotes because you can see, oh, this is just like adding a thing to an object. It's just that I made a function that just does that. And it's something I do all the time. So it's easier to see that it could be something reused. And so in JavaScript, The Good Parts, he talks a lot about how, well, you're using a function to create a scope. And then now you can do information hiding because you can return a function that will modify that thing, but nothing else can modify it. And, you know, these are the things that functional programmers think about. This is functional programming. It's like using all these little pieces and composing them together into a solution that you want, as opposed to having it kind of like ready-made for you in this object that does all sorts of stuff. Like it holds state, has an interface, it hides the implementation details, it's sort of like a unit of meaning. I mean, it does all sorts of stuff. It's like a namespace kind of. And if you read that book, you start to see that these things are better when they're broken apart, that they're smaller, they're easier to understand, and now you can build the solution you want. And I think that JavaScript Elongée does the same thing. It starts to show you that, look, these functions, not a class, but a function is so useful because you can build other functions out of it. You can, like, because in JavaScript, it has the function scope. You can build a new scope out of it. You know, it's all this cool stuff.
So you mentioned higher order functions and React and React Native. We have higher order components and higher order functions and higher order functional components. Is that a functional programming principle?
Yeah. It's very similar to what in object-oriented land is called dependency injection.
Really?
The difference is it doesn't require so much like elaboration. Really, you're passing in a function that something else is going to call, just like a callback. And that thing is going to call it, but you kind of don't know exactly how it's going to be called. I mean, it's part of the semantics of the thing you're calling. And it just lets you start thinking in higher order terms, meaning you're not thinking like, oh, I have to construct this for loop. You're thinking, oh, this is a map. So I'm going to call map and pass it the function that I want done to all the elements. The same goes with higher order components. You can take a component as a, you know, and the idea is that it's, and as much as possible, it's a function. It's just like a render function. And you pass that to something else, and that will transform it into a new component. So maybe it's a component that keeps track of its state, like it has an undo or something like that.
I have another question about React, I guess, in general. And I know with Redux and with a lot of the modules and things that we're kind of using in the React ecosystem, we see these curried functions. And I'm curious, is currying like a functional programming principle as well? Because I believe I may like have read that somewhere. And if so, like, you know, how does like that all work, I guess? I mean, I understand how curring works, but like, you know, is it used, I guess, in other languages as well?
Yeah. So just a bit of history. Currying comes from a person named Haskell Curry. And Haskell is also the language Haskell, the functional language, comes from his first name. So currying is from his last name. Haskell is his first name. So yeah, it's a functional programming concept. And I mean, I for one am really glad that people in JavaScript are learning this stuff. Like I said before, it's amazing that you hear a JavaScript programmer saying the word curry and they know what it means. And it's just great. Redux itself is very functional. It was inspired by other functional languages like ClojureScript and Elm. I think Redux is another example of like where, and React in general, of where how much functional programming is actually being done in JavaScript right now.
That's interesting. Yeah.
You know, what's really funny is additionally with that, so ACM Magazine usually could care less about JavaScript if you've ever tried to read it. It's usually about image perturbation with like a functional, like deep down to the core. And they had an article, I want to say earlier this year, on React being Facebook's functional turn on writing JavaScript. And of course, the article is available for everybody, but you know, combining with that, Redux, and then additionally, I think Peter might be a fan as well. I'm definitely a big fan of Rhonda, which is a functional JavaScript library, which automatically curries all of your functions for you. And it's just amazing to me. I mean, this is my gateway drug. It's slowly making more and more functional programming. And, you know, speaking of Haskell, that's what used to scare some people away. I mean, right. If somebody gets thrown into Haskell where it is strict, it is insanely philosophical up front. And so you say not having a for loop, you know, like how about not being able to, you know, kind of like maintain any mutable variables at all. Just you start to lose your mind when you're thrown into something like that from a different programming language. And to me, it's really cool coming back to those same concepts and seeing languages and entire libraries like Rhonda where you can do these things. These are the real kind of friendly ways to bring people into a functional set of programmers those millennials with the Lisp and such.
Gant and I were just talking about Ramda before we jumped on this call, because I've never used Ramda before, maybe once or twice when I was using the Infinite Red starter kit. So I've always been like Lodash and Lodash FP, or just like hand rolling, you know, functions that I've learned from Alange, you know, but I'm like, there's got to be better ways for me to do this than just have, you know, a bunch of hand rolled functions. So just exploring different libraries and seeing what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, I'm all for the exploration. I have recently read an article that is kind of, well, it's kind of critical of JavaScript as a functional language, and has a good point. Like I said, I'm all for people learning all this functional stuff. It's good stuff. It complements the object-oriented stuff really well, and the procedural stuff. But the problem they were running into was when you start trying to use multiple libraries. So, you know, you're using Lodash and you're using immutable.js. Well, now you've got all these, like, you have to know, am I using an immutable list, or do I have a JavaScript array? And it starts to get a little cumbersome. I'm sure there's a solution to this, you know, like another wrapper around them, another level of indirection that will just solve the problem. Yeah, I think it's still a problem that, you know, you want to do things right. You want to do things as functional as possible. So you import all these libraries that give you all these tools, and they don't quite work well together.
Yeah. And also the fact is, you know, a lot of this stuff is not baked into the language itself. So we're importing and using all these, you know, libraries and stuff like that. And those things, you know, they change, their APIs change, they add right. extra bloat if you're using, you know, if you're doing web programming. But, you know, one of the main things that I use Lodash for is to do map, filter, and reduce on objects. I wonder why that mm-hmm. isn't added into the language itself. And also, is that something you can do in other languages on other data structures other than arrays?
Oh, yeah, for sure. In ClojureScript, you can do a reduce on a map, and it will give you a sequence. You know, it'll give you each pair, meaning the key value pair, and you can do so. Map is interesting because map, you could actually just do something like map values and get the same structure, meaning the same keys, but now all your values are changed. Or you could do something where you get both the key and the value, and you can transform them in some other way. And then, so the key set might be different when it comes out. So there's different ways to do it. So yeah, it's totally possible.
I wonder, is there any discussion of adding that functionality to JavaScript that anyone knows about? I haven't heard. I don't know if there's a reason behind it or if it's just something that they haven't thought about. I'm sure they've thought about it, but I'm assuming there's a reason that it's not there, because so many people use Lodash just for that reason.
Well, right.
JavaScript hasn't evolved for a long time and just began evolving again. I mean, for the longest time, the language just sat stagnant.
And for the longest time, we didn't even have object.keys, right?
Yeah, it's really bad. It didn't have dot includes. And so, I mean, it was really a sad, and that caused the fragmentation in JavaScript. All these different libraries claiming all these different micro benchmarking speeds, and
right,
and everybody's Jesus, oh, I know size. This one, yeah, exactly. And it was just very poisonous for JavaScript. It's definitely turning towards a light, but JavaScript, in its innate sort of place, had. It basically became stagnant and toxic for a good while, which was why, and that's when everybody was on client languages, you know, and that was the future. So now here we are back. The longer things change, the more they stay the same.
And let's not forget that this was just like 3, you know, maybe 4 years ago.
Yeah, not that long ago.
Right? Like, go ahead.
I comment on this all the time because I do give a presentation about, you know, JavaScript versus ClojureScript, just to help people understand what ClojureScript is about. And I keep saying, like, You know, the last time I really used JavaScript long term at a job was before ES6. It was like old school JavaScript. And this was before NPM, before, I don't even know, the Webpack, all that stuff. We would concatenate. We would use the Unix cat command to put our JavaScript files together into one bundle. And it worked. It worked perfectly. It just had no problems. We never had to upgrade. We never had to deal with any, you know, new features of the packer. Like, it was just cat.
That's OG JavaScript.
Yeah. That's what I remember. And so when people talk about, oh, I'm trying to configure my Bower, I'm like, I have no idea what you're doing. I just, you're on cat.
I wonder if it would be possible to create a Babel plugin that allowed you to kind of do these things and add these things to the language. Is that something that you can do with Babel? I mean, I think when I understand it, it is, but do you think it would be something?
I would love to see that. I would really love to see that because, you know, when people started really transpiling, like everybody's transpiling now, and importing all these modules like from the future, you know, like level zero. I thought we would start seeing more like homegrown modules that that did this kind of stuff. Like, for instance, replacing all the literals, the JavaScript object and array literals with immutable.js. You could do that with a module that just, you know, change the syntax. And I just wonder why we haven't seen more stuff like that, at least even experiments. Yeah. And
that may be an experiment. I may try to create a module that, or a Babel plugin that does object.reduce and object.map and object.filter.
Well, it's fair to say at this point, you know, as React Native developers, we've always been benefiting from Babel. Now, take this with a grain of salt. There are quite a few people who know quite a lot more about this than I do. But with React Native Packager, and I'm sure, Eric, I don't mean to step on your toes on this one, but it definitely with React Native Packager, I think he was going to talk about it for a second, but moving off into its own library and sort of the ability to tie in at the Babel level with a CLI config, even though we've been writing ES7 and all the fancy stuff that's getting transpiled for React Native development, recently it's really opened up the transpiling initiative. So you can do just about any language that transpiles and start getting things moving real fast.
Yeah. Wow. I have a lot to say about that. First thing I want to say is, yes, it is awesome that it like opens up everything because it kind of puts all languages on an even playing field. I mean, basically, if you're transpiling anyway, why not choose the language you want, right? So that means you could do PureScript or TypeScript or ClojureScript. Why be stuck with ES7? And especially when you're when it's, you know, still being modified, so you do an update and your level zero stuff starts breaking. And anyway, you have this opportunity because everything's transpiled now. Just transpile from what you want. The other thing I have to say is that I don't know how that's going to affect ClojureScript because we've had our own tooling to build React Native stuff for a long time. And we kind of built on top of what was there instead of, not to be derogatory or anything, instead of waiting for React to support this.
Good call.
We've just built on top. And so we have had like live code reloading. So, you know, basically you are, you know, you're running your program in your iPhone simulator or on your phone. And you type some code, you save it, it gets compiled automatically by the ClojureScript compiler. So not really even touching React at all, not like talking to it. And then through a WebSocket, it sends the phone a command that says, hey, this file is updated, download it again, and it just reloads it and you see the change right there. You don't have to like shake your phone. You don't have to like lose where you were. So you can like do, I don't know if I can do it justice just by describing it, but you can literally do styling changes and save it as you go and just watch your style change on a deep screen. You know, you're like three things in, you got stuff, you've typed stuff in, you've selected stuff, and you can watch it change like right before your eyes. I don't know if JavaScript has gotten there yet where you can do stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that ClojureScript went that far before these toolings have been opened up. I mean, it's amazing to me that it kind of speaks to the metal of the people just to say, oh, yeah, well, is this available? No? Okay, well, we're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, I think we were lucky that a lot of the stuff already existed, because that's the way we would program the web too. So when React Native came out, someone had also been experimenting with how do you do live coding on an iPhone in JavaScript or in ClojureScript, sorry. And so they just kind of ported all these pieces and made this system that works well.
Yeah, it definitely, it seems to have caught up pretty nicely, and then very open to what languages are being transpiled from, especially the most recent edition. So just, I guess it almost is a little scary, because now that we have the options, which ones are we going to have that same fragmentation problem that we saw before with, you know, all the different JavaScript libraries? Or is it going to be every company that you work with is going to say, hey, we wrote it in this language. We need you to go ahead and continue working with this language now. And then you switch over and then you have to relearn everything again. I almost kind of wish there was, you know, which ones are doing the best, you know, and we're doing our bets on what we think is going to succeed, but there's no guarantees right now with JavaScript.
Yeah, it could be a thing like how we did see the fragmentation in the languages in the frameworks where there was a lot of fragmentation for a couple of years, but now we're kind of seeing a little less fragmentation that people kind of settle on a couple of things. So maybe there will be an explosion of language of compiled to JS languages, and then maybe we will see fragmentation, and then possibly kind of people moving down into just a handful of languages, or maybe JavaScript will improve to the point where we won't need to do this stuff. I don't know. I know there's other issues other than the syntax that some of these other languages kind of bring to the table, such as, you know, types and things like that. I have a question, though. This is kind of about functional programming in general. I see this ML syntax, or this ML tacked on to different languages like Reason ML and OCaml. What does ML like actually mean? And is it something that people add to a language name to kind of represent that it is a functional language? And where did that come from?
So ML is one of the original typed functional languages. It's actually standard ML.
So ML is an actual language in and of itself. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And it is kind of the pre-runner for OCaml, for Haskell, and then all the ones derived similar to Haskell, like Elm and PureScript. So it's just an old language that was functional and had the stuff that you're used to: currying, pattern matching, type inference, that kind of thing.
Nader, going back to what you were saying with JavaScript and the community, I feel like JavaScript being this like, you know, cross browser language, you know, that like has a lot of different targets, and all these like new developers coming into every single day, I think at this point there are so many people with so many opinions I don't know if we'll ever be able to, you know, like come together and agree, like, this is the way we're going to do things, you know, because think about like, even like Lodash being like the standard library of JavaScript, you could argue, has like so many different competitors, you know, like even just like Lodash and Ramda. And, you know, I've even heard people on Reddit say that they've replaced Lodash with Immutable completely, you know. And like, I've always considered like Lodash the standard, the library I'm always going to use, you know, and I even have like several flavors of that library to use, you know, and I'm sure there's many more.
Yeah. One of the things about, you know, talking about fragmentation, I think that JavaScript has a healthy user base. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. What you are going to see is, and it's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to move. Like, people aren't going to move to like scatter across like thousands of languages and will never be able to communicate. It's always going to be there, and it's always going to be influenced by these other languages. So, you know, you could see that JavaScript already was influenced by Scheme and Self when it was created. And now a lot of the influence is from CoffeeScript with the syntax changes that have happened recently. I'm sure that at some point, the more functional languages are going to influence it again in terms of what, you know, what features get added officially to the language. I think that you're just going to see, all these like a few splinter groups for people who, I don't know, feel like for some reason there's an advantage there, and it's going to feed back into the main group slowly. You know, this is 20 years we're talking about. That's my prediction of what's going to happen.
So I have a question. Have you looked into Reason at all? And if so, like, what do you think about the language or the toolkit or whatever they call it?
I haven't looked at it. And actually, I feel like things are moving so fast that often I'll like look at it and be like, that's interesting. And then I put in a folder to read later, and I realize that there's like 300 things in that folder. So what is Reason? Tell me.
I haven't looked at it a ton, but I know Peter, we had a guest on last week that specializes in Reason, and that episode will be out probably next Monday. And I'm looking forward to listening to that. But from what I understand, it's basically a tool chain built on top of OCaml. They're using it at Facebook. They're replacing a lot of their code at Facebook with Reason, to the best of my understanding.
So this is to replace Babel and Webpack and stuff like that?
Well, it's also a compiled to JS language. So I'm going to let Peter kind of take over.
Reason ML stands for Reason Markup Language, and it uses the OCaml AST behind the scenes, right? So OCaml by default comes with types, it comes with Immutable, and all these other features that we could really take advantage of in JavaScript, right? We've done the best we could to make up for that with FlowType, with TypeScript, you know, with Immutable JS, but we can do better than that. So Jordan Walk from Facebook, you know, a bunch of other folks came together and started working on Reason ML. So all it's doing is it's taking OCaml and giving you a new syntax that's much more familiar to JavaScript, so you don't have to worry about, you know, learning OCaml. You can learn Reason and get the same benefits of OCaml, right? Immutable, the performance that comes with it, but not having to relearn all that syntax all over again. And Natter, you're right. Facebook's Messenger is using like 25% Reason right now. Writing Reason generally is more performant than fine-tuning your JavaScript. And the code, the compiled JavaScript code that you get from Reason, is pretty legible too, right? It's not like opening up something that you've transformed with Babel, for example. It's looking better and better, and it's a lot more legible. And they actually encourage you to check in your compiled JavaScript code.
Hmm. That's really interesting. I just want to say for a second there, just to tie in with a few things, there's definitely a jump across a bridge to switch languages, right? I see that there's definitely things missing. So I want to take a moment. I say, I think it's awesome that Facebook's going that direction. I think they needed to pick a direction to go towards. But seeing as the fragmentation is going to happen with all these things, I want to put my two cents into two things. One, I just want to say real quick, if you're familiar with JavaScript, jumping over to TypeScript is nothing. It's magical. So, and it's weird for me to say anything that backs Microsoft, but I find myself doing it more and more every day. Now, if you're willing to switch languages and you're willing to kind of go the full length, I honestly would say go ahead and take a moment. Maybe look at, you know, purelyfunctional.tv. Take a look at the other languages. I wouldn't just jump in because Facebook says this is what you should use. I'd say, like, take a look at ClojureScript. Take a look at all the other ones. If you're looking to switch languages completely, take a step back and spend some time on it. And I think that you'd probably be a lot happier looking at a sort of a higher order language that's built around that stuff. But if you're looking to stay with JavaScript, TypeScript gives you so many of that magic without feeling like you've changed languages. So I'm happy Facebook's doing this, but I can't barrel down after the old camel train and say yes, because I remember I was at the talk when they announced this, and I was like, what are they talking about? So I don't know if the clarity is continuing to grow, but I would do some home investigation with that stuff. But it sounds like you've done a lot, Peter. And, you know, honestly, Eric's got the most experience with these functional programming languages, so I'd probably ask him.
Yeah, Eric, I'm curious what your opinion is about what the most applicable functional languages for a JavaScript developer, if they want to kind of expand their tool set and learn something not only fun, but maybe they can use to actually get a job doing it or get a contract working with it.
Yeah. So this is a really hard question because I think everybody's different and they're looking for different things. I think TypeScript and Flow are really interesting because if you're looking to learn the typed functional languages, those two, and I think Flow might be a little bit better for this. But if you're looking for like to get into typed functional programming without really changing languages, that's really awesome. If you want to jump right in to a language that has a really good beginner focus, and I think it's only for the web right now, but there's Elm. Elm is has an amazing beginner experience. You know, type errors in functional languages are really bad in general and really hard to decipher, and you'll spend so much time just trying to get your thing to compile. But Elm has such good error messages, and it's kept a very simple type system, very powerful, but simple. It's simple enough that they can kind of cover all of the error message types and give you really nice messages from them. There's, if you want to like go all the way in the deep end, there's PureScript. PureScript is like Haskell, but targeted at the JavaScript ecosystem. So it's got very advanced types. People talk about monads there. If that's what you're into, that's there. Now, ClojureScript is kind of separate from those because it's not typed. It's not strongly typed. So if you are into more of the, you want immutable data structures, you want higher order functions, you want a good standard library, and you want good interop, but you don't want to have to learn types, you can learn all that stuff in ClojureScript. And ClojureScript has a good I would say as a ClojureScript for React Native and for like React development is really a nice experience. Like I said, you have the live reloading. There's decent error messages. There's source maps, so you can debug right in your original source code. And the setup is, you know, a couple of commands. You install a few things, and then you type, you know, go, and you can start editing code. So that's my recommendations.
Okay. So, Eric, we kind of got off track at the beginning of the show, but I'm curious as to what you do right now and kind of, you know, what you're working on in your day-to-day, like, career and your day-to-day work.
Yeah, right now I am full-time working on a company that I started called PurelyFunctional.tv, and I'm mostly making video tutorials for Clojure and ClojureScript. And that is a lot of work, you know, running your own business. Right now it's mostly subscription based. So what I mean by that is you there's a all you can eat subscription. You become a member, there's a monthly fee or a yearly fee, and you get access to everything old and new, you know, new stuff as it comes out. And then you can also buy the courses individually, but it's a much better deal to just go all in and get everything. I try to keep everything super practical. You know, that means making sure that it's going to be something that people actually want to use. I do like to go a little bit into theory and philosophy, but mostly it's like, let's get something done. Let's get something working. And my main audience, it's not to limit anybody, but my main audience is people who want to learn functional programming to use at work. So either their current job or, you know, a future job that they'll transition to.
So I see you have a ton of videos here. So have you become like a master of creating video tutorials during this experience of creating your own business? Because I'm kind of getting into that whole video tutorial thing, and I've put quite a few on YouTube, and I'm going to be adding more. And I found it to be much more challenging than I ever thought it would be.
Yeah, it's tough. I've been doing it for a few years now, so I've probably forgotten more than I even know. When I started, it was like a Kickstarter, and I just wanted to do intro to Clojure. My first idea was I'm going to make like all of Clojure, right, on videos. But then I would want something like $50,000 on Kickstarter to do that, and I could quit my job and just live off of that. But then someone convinced me, hey, if someone gave you $3,000, would you make something smaller and not quit your job? And I said, yeah, probably. So then I reduced the Kickstarter down that, and I reduced the scope to just be intro to Clojure. And when I did that, you know, I spent a lot of time on production quality. You know, I got a microphone. I worked on slides and put animation in them. I made sure every little bit worked together to make this really cohesive whole. And it was great. I think it works really well. The problem is the courses take a long time to make. And while I'm making the courses, nobody's learning. So, I mean, they can learn from my older courses, but they can't learn the new stuff. And so over time, I've focused more on content and less on polish, like video polish, because I find that people are just insatiable for content. And so if that's my advice, if you're going to get into this, is really think about where the sweet spot is between quantity and quality. Because, you know, at this point, I'm better off making a course quickly, or making even one lesson, getting it out there and getting people asking me questions about it. And then I can just put those answers into the next lesson. Whereas if it takes 3 months to even get the course out there before anyone can see it, because you want it to be like a totally coherent whole. You don't get that feedback, and you have to do, you know, that much more prep up front to make sure it is answering every possible question. So, yeah, I think a lot about this. I think about like the best way to film. I've got a whole setup for doing, you know, recording my keystrokes and stuff. You know, my screen as I type in an editor. Yeah, it's just a lot of little pieces.
Yeah, it's a lot of little pieces, and it's a lot of kind of being, I guess, aware of all these little things going on and kind of putting them together. Because when you watch a video tutorial, you don't really realize all of the work that's been put into it until you actually try to do one yourself. And it's been really, really hard getting used to it. I've gotten much more comfortable now, but I'm still, you know, when I kick off a new video, I always feel extremely awkward at first. So I don't know, maybe that feeling goes away after a while.
I think it does, especially if you do it more often, you know, not just the number of times, but more often, like you'll still be in the zone for the next one. You know, you talk about details. Like one of the details that I had to figure out was not to have my cursor blink, because, you know, video stretches and compresses well, meaning you can stretch the time and compress it. So no one wants to watch you type at 1x, right? It's too slow. They can read much faster than that. So you put it at maybe 2x or 3x, but then your cursor is blinking so much. And then there's some parts where you kind of want to slow down. Now it's blinking slower and it's just a distraction. So yeah, there's all sorts of little things like that, like configuring your editor so that it looks good on different screen sizes, and you know, you can play with the video in different ways, and you know, making it so that if you make a mistake, it's okay. Like you can like fix it in post, or you can redo it. You know, that's all that stuff. It's really hard to figure out.
I feel like there could be like, I know this is React Native podcast, but I feel like if we got the three of us in a room and started talking about the process of making screencasts, mm-hmm. that would be a really cool chat just in by itself.
Oh, yeah.
And I know like Peter is working on his microphone setup. As being, you know, a developer becomes more and more communicating via technology, being a remote developer or being somebody who has to send a message to someone else, not just through their app, but through their videos and their communication. Like there's an entire spectrum. Natter, you should make a note here, man. This is you could do a special podcast just on all this stuff alone, because I am enthralled in what other people have gone through and figuring out the same stuff, right? And I think that's amazing. So I feel like there's definitely a need for helping others out there, especially people looking to buy their own microphones, go through the process, maybe even understand what editing and post feels like.
Right. And then like even once you edit, you're not done. You still have to encode your video. There's all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great idea. Maybe we can do an entire episode on maybe content creation, including podcasting and screencasting, and maybe even a little bit about blogging and stuff like that.
That's awesome. Yeah. Bring Eric in, and everybody, I'm sure there's quite a few other video people that would be good for that.
And those are careers of their own, you know, like how do you find the time to, you know, like figure out podcasting stuff? Like I'm literally looking at a freaking Canon 7D that I set up on a tripod that I've been like trying to figure out how to throw into my like workflow for like videos and stuff, you know, versus just using my laptop camera, you know, and like then dealing with that footage. And then I'm like, crap, like, do I really want to deal with like 1080p plus footage right now? Or isn't it just easier to just take it right off my like laptop camera, you know, just stuff like that.
Exactly.
Too.
Oh, yeah. And not only that microphone, if you're doing a video meeting, you know, tomorrow or the next day, like you can't have the setup where it's going to be in frame all the time as well. But yeah, I think there's a million questions. There's like a new science here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm seriously thinking about having single purpose computers for, you know, like one is going to, I'm going to record This one is just for editing video. One is for my, you know, coding work that I still have to do. And then another one is going to be for recording the video. So it's going to have a nice camera USB connected right into it. Like, I think that we're getting to that point where, like, moving a laptop around so that you can, like, be in different places to, you know, it's not working anymore. I'm going to need Raspberry Pis for everything.
I mean, take a look at musicians. I mean, they don't have to write their songs in the studio.
Right.
They just have to be ready to record it there.
Yeah. Then the problem is, like, getting all the data to where it needs to go. So the video files are big.
All right, cool. Well, yeah, we'll definitely do that soon.
So, yeah, count me in.
Yeah, definitely. We'll definitely do that. We'll bring you back on for that. So I think we'll go ahead and jump to the picks now. So I guess I'll start with Gant. Do you have any picks today, Gant?
Absolutely. I have to say that I don't know when this recording is going to be out there, but for sure, I want to say that the Chain React conference is coming up. As of this recording, it's in 13 days. You will see such fantastic people like Natter will be doing a presentation there. And it's really exciting to have the React Native conference coming here inside, or the React Native conference in the US happening soon. I'm going to see all my favorite people. Eric, I'm surprised you didn't submit a talk. That would have been a good one for you to come out there, especially with all the React Native stuff. So you better submit next year. But yeah. I don't know when. Oh, the videos will be available, of course. If you're hearing this after the conference, we'll be going through Conf Freaks. So you'll see everything that you want and it'll be fantastic, but you will have missed an amazing conference.
Totally, totally looking forward to that conference. Can't wait. I need to talk to you about the talk name because I believe they still have my old talk name on the app. But I'll touch base with you later on today about that. So Peter, do you have any picks?
Yeah, so my pick for this week, like I foreshadowed earlier, is JavaScript on Langer, the ES6 edition. So when I first read it, it was whatever they used to call it, ES3, ES5, I don't know anymore. Anyway, this one's rewritten, ES2016. Definitely check it out. A lot of the stuff that we talked about today, Reginald Brightworth goes into very good detail, especially how you can apply it to everyday work scenarios. If you read it online, it's free. Otherwise, if you want to buy it, it's like $35. Definitely worth buying it because it's been an incredible book and it's definitely helped shape my career.
I tell you what, I'm buying that book right now.
All right, Eric, do you have any picks?
I do. And this is going to be a weird one. We talked about using map filter and reduce in JavaScript and how those are kind of a good way to get into functional programming in whatever language you're in, and how even in Clojure, when people are learning, like they still are, even though those are like way more idiomatic, they don't do it. Well, I read a book called Refactoring to Collections, which is about functional PHP. It's about map filter and reduce in PHP. And it was a super successful book in terms of, you know, the number of sales. And so it's, to me, it's like an inspiration. Like if you can teach PHP programmers functional programming, well, JavaScript programmers will have no trouble. And so check out that book if you've ever had to use PHP. It will show you how PHP could be better if you just do a little magic with functional programming. And that would be kind of like the model that I would use for doing a course in JavaScript. Please steal the idea if you want to do it before I do. I'm going to do that one day. So that's my pick.
My pick is going to be GraphCool. I'm not sure if we've picked this before or not, but I've just started using it. It's basically a backend as a service for GraphQL, and I would say it's similar to like Firebase or something like that, but I kind of got up and running with it about a week ago. I'm really enjoying it, and I think we're going to have those guys on the show in about a month or so, so check out for that.
I'd like to second GraphQool. somebody who, you know, like I'm more of a startup person than I am, you know, an open source person. So I used to spend all this time writing my SQL queries in Postgres and then writing the APIs and then figuring out how to connect all the data. Now I literally just make my GraphQL schema directly in graph.cool and it just works. So definitely an incredible tool. Just wanted to give them another shout out.
Yeah. And then additionally, I want to say that Natter, you did an amazing article on Medium talking about React Native and such. So I know you didn't want to pat yourself on the back with that one. So I'm doing it for you. Definitely look at the React Native training Medium articles that Natter's putting out, especially if this pick seems foreign to you. A good way to pick it up is to look at what he's writing.
Thank you. Yeah, that posted pretty good. And I'm going to be having a new one come out this week as well about Microsoft Mobile Center, adding analytics and code push. So yeah, check out the blog when this comes out. You'll see two fairly new articles. So, okay, well, that wraps up episode 68 of React Native Radio. Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think we had a really deep dive into functional programming, and I think a lot of people are going to enjoy it.
Great. I had a blast. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, we'll definitely see you back when we talk about podcasts and and recording and all the other cool stuff. Because especially as you being a person who records that stuff, wow. I think that plus functional programming is really hot right now.
Yeah. I'm a trendsetter.
Let's start a new podcast where we just talk about our recording equipment and then which JavaScript derivative we should go with.
Count me in. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you all next week.